Good morning and welcome to the June 16th edition of Mountain Money. I'm your host, Roger Goldman. I'm here with my co-host, Kevin Kennedy.
Morning, Good morning. Kevin. Good morning, everyone.
Got a great show coming up today. We're going to start by speaking with Noam Schieber about ongoing developments in the business of big law. And then we'll speak with Bridget Reed, author of Little Bosses Everywhere, a look at the murky world of multi-level marketing. We'll be right back after this. Back in March, the prestigious law firm Paul Weiss entered into an unusual agreement with the U.S. government to resolve sanctions that had been laid out in an executive order issued by President Trump. A number of major law firms entered into similar agreements, but other law firms adopted a different approach. On the phone to talk about the business considerations that presumably went into these decisions and some of the fallout that is resulting in the world of big law is New York Times business reporter Noam Schieber. Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So let's set the stage a little bit, Noam. Can you share with the audience a little bit about the stated basis for that original executive order with respect to Paul Weiss and what would have been its impact?
Yeah, so Paul Weiss, like other firms that the Trump White House targeted with executive orders and potential executive orders, in the minds of the Trump folks, I think that their offenses were really twofold. One, they employed partners who had investigated or attempted to investigate President Trump or attempted to prosecute President Trump. And in many cases, they had refused to represent President Trump or clients on the, or people on the right after January 6th, when the government prosecuted people who were involved in that. So there was a sense that these firms, at least from the perspective of the Trump administration, had really put their fingers on the scales and were really kind of partisan actors who were arrayed against President Trump and working with his critics and his opponents. So if you read the executive order against Paul Weiss, it uses terms like, undermining the judicial process. They were engaged in harmful activity, egregious conduct, destroying bedrock American principles. And all this was in the context of, kind of attacking and criticizing and investigating President Trump and his allies and working with his opponents. And in terms of the fallout, these were incredibly serious, really existential consequences that these firms faced, Paul Weiss and others that were subject to these executive orders. The orders suspended their security clearances, so lawyers would not have had access to classified or highly sensitive material. They limited the access to federal government buildings. They threatened contractors who hired these firms with the loss of their contracts. So, this really could have made it impossible for firms like Paul Weiss to do business, whether it was just setting foot on government property or essentially pressuring a lot of their clients to abandon them in favor of other firms. This was something that they saw as a real existential threat to their business. And so it's understandable why they took it so seriously.
And some of the executive orders were kind of interesting. I know one of the things that was stated against the Perkins Coie firm, which we'll talk about a bit later, was the fact that persons who are no longer working there had engaged in things like the Steele dossier. So it was sort of going after them for people who weren't there anymore, which I thought was very strange.
Yes, and in many cases, these lawyers had left the firm. And in one case, a lawyer who had been part of the Mueller investigation during Trump's first term had been a partner at one of these firms, then left that firm a few years ago, and that firm was still targeted. So yes, the kind of memory when it came to opponents and enemies of the president was very long, and it didn't help the firms if those people had moved on since then.
Okay, so we had these various executive orders. They didn't seem to be based on what would be historic principles of why one would take an action. Most of them, I believe, had some reference to diversity hiring practices, as if that was a basis for looking at these firms. But I, again, a lot of them had these political references that you just made. So A firm like Paul Weiss is looking at this. Some of the provisions of these orders said things like you can't go into a government building, or you know, or clients, you can't represent, sort of clients of these firms would not be allowed to obtain government contracts. So they were very sweeping sanctions. What did Paul Weiss do about it?
Yeah, so Paul Weiss was a very interesting case because before Paul Weiss got involved, no firm had made a deal with the government. The first few, you mentioned Perkins Coie, the first few firms hit with these executive orders had just fought them in court. And initially it looked like Paul Weiss was gonna do the same thing. The chairman of the firm, Brad Karp, had been reaching out to other firms to try to present a united front against the Trump administration for issuing these executive orders. He had been trying to organize a kind of industry-wide amicus brief so that a lot of the big law firms would stand together. He had even talked to a very prominent conservative lawyer named Bill Burke at Quinn Emanuel, who had represented the Trump organization, about having Mr. Burke represent Paul Weiss and at least help kind of signal that this was a united front within the legal industry in standing up to and opposing these executive orders. But then sort of late in the game, Mr. Karp, I think, realized that he wasn't going to get the united front that he had counted on, that a lot of the firms that he thought would join him in standing up and signaling their disapproval of these executive orders were actually sort of abandoning him. It was this sort of Gary Cooper high noon moment. And he even felt that that some of these firms trying to poach his clients, trying to steal partners from him. And so kind of late in the game, he reversed course and actually flies down to the White House and meets with President Trump personally to hammer out a deal. And so he really does this 180, going from trying to lead the industry opposition to these executive orders to trying to broker a deal with President Trump. And he's ultimately successful in doing that. Paul Weiss becomes the first large firm to reach a deal. They agree to do $40 million in pro bono work on causes that are sort of aligned with causes that the president prioritizes. And then it sort of gets very interesting after that. You know, the firms that did these deals, beginning with Paul Weiss, say that they didn't really agree to anything that they wouldn't have done under other circumstances. You know, they all do tens of millions of dollars of pro bono work each year. They said, you know, what they agreed to was very consistent with the pro bono work they already did. You know, it was things like, you know, agreeing to represent clients no matter what their political views. It was, you know, representing veterans and first responders and combating anti-Semitism. So the firm, Paul Weiss, understood itself to be sort of signing on to things like this that are sort of, you know, hard to disagree with. I think the president had a different view of the nature of this deal. In the president's telling, the firm, Paul Weiss, and other firms that later made deals were really sort of acknowledging quote unquote wrongdoing. And the money that they set aside for pro bono work, Trump considered it damages for wronging him and other people on the right. And he really looked at this, the pro bono money that they had set aside, as kind of as what my colleagues who reported on this called a war chest that he could kind of use as needed, whether it was, you know, to help the Department of Justice or DOGE, you know, the Elon Musk organization that's looking for efficiencies in government, or even, you know, force them to represent him or his allies if they got caught up in political investigations. So the two sides had sort of very different understandings of what the nature of this deal was and what it obligated Paul Weiss and other firms to do.
I want to talk a little bit more about that, but I want to go back a minute and talk just for a minute about why it was so significant that this was Paul Weiss. I mean, talk a little bit about who that firm is in the legal community.
Yeah, Paul Weiss, a very respected firm, 150 years old, goes back to the 19th century. And for years, I think they had been known for, you know, really three things, I think. One is being at the kind of the leading edge of a lot of important civil rights battles, including, you know, they were among, I think, the first firm the big New York firms to employ both Jews and WASPs, you know, Jews and non-Jews in the same firm, which was a big sort of norm that was shattered by them. They a Paul Weiss partner led the litigation for the case that that basically legalized gay marriage nationally. Had a very, very active pro bono practice, you know, tens of millions of dollars a year that they would spend representing very clients with very limited resources and incredibly big high stakes fights. During the first Trump term, they sent dozens of lawyers to the border, you know, to deal with the fallout from Trump's more aggressive immigration policy. So this is a firm that really had associated itself both with pro bono work generally, but also, you know, kind of specifically sort of civil rights and progressive causes in the pro bono sphere. So when Paul Weiss, with this really storied legacy in these areas, made a deal with Trump, it was really seen as one of the kind of icons of big law making a deal that that a lot of people saw as a departure from their history.
Now, big law has changed over the years. One of the things you just talked about was the fact that the other law firms would not sort of join with Paul Weiss to stand up. Can you talk a little bit about the culture of big law and why you think that was?
Yeah, so I'd say the last 20 years in particular have been a very interesting time in the evolution of big law. And they've really made the business of big law very, very fragile, even as they've made it very profitable at the same time. So what we've seen over the past two decades or so is this real arms race for legal talent, for partners who can bring in business, and, you know, and for the clients that those partners bring in. It's not unusual over the past 15, 20 years to see firms lure a partner from a rival and to promise them, you know, to guarantee them annual salaries of $15, even $20 million a year. So the partners at big law firms are now getting paid like investment bankers or hedge fund managers in a way that was not the case, you know, 25, 30 years ago. Law partners were always very well compensated, but we used to see salaries kind of in the low millions rather than in the double digit millions. So this really there really became a big arms race to lure these rainmakers, these big these partners with a big book of business over the past 15, 20 years. And the problem with that model is, while it can be very lucrative when you succeed at landing one of these legal free agents, the concern, and in some cases the reality, is that they can leave your firm as quickly as they arrive. And if suddenly something happens to your firm, you know, maybe a major client leaves it, or there's some sense that the future is not going to be as sunny as the past was, and one or two partners decide to leave, then it can start almost like the law firm equivalent of a bank run, where suddenly a lot of partners are sort of stampeding toward the exits, and a firm can collapse, actually. We've seen this a few times over the past 15, 20 years. There's a Yale law professor, John Morley, who studies this, who really compares it to a bank run, the way, you know, depositors could sort of start to withdraw all their money and leave the bank insolvent. And we've literally seen this happen to firms. It's something that all law firm leaders in this kind of free agent world have to think about, and it's something they worry about constantly. And so I think when the president started hitting these firms with executive orders, this was very front of mind with these law firm leaders, the concern that if a few big rainmakers left, suddenly, you know, that would deprive the firm of clients and profits, and other partners would start to get antsy and the whole thing would unravel. And I think that was one of the things that really made them think twice about fighting the administration and ultimately kind of pressured them to do a deal.
And I believe that there were some indications that while Paul Weiss was in the process of deciding what to do, firms were reaching out to some of their big rainmakers in an effort to poach them away.
Yeah, this is contested. I mean, Brad Karp, the chairman of Paul Weiss, says that, you know, he was getting indications that other firms were reaching out to partners and trying to poach them. the firms that he identified as doing this denied that they did that. You know, I think the truth is probably somewhere in between, that there were conversations. My colleagues have reported that the conversations that happened when other firms reached out to Paul Weiss Partners were in the vein of, you know, expressing sympathy, you know, saying that they kind of understood the dilemma that they were in. And, you know, if they wanted to talk more, they, you know, they'd be open to talking. So it was, I assume it was kind of, it was all implicit. But certainly Brad Karp interpreted that as a direct threat to his firm and to his business. And it really ratcheted up the pressure. And I think, you know, clearly affected his calculation about whether to do a deal with the Trump administration or not.
Now, we want to get to what's happened since this. But first, let's touch on, well, why did firms like some firms decided to contest it and went to court? What happened then?
Yeah, so a handful of firms did contest these executive orders. Jenner and Block, based in Chicago, Wilmer Cutler, a very prominent firm in D.C., Perkins Coie, who we mentioned. And I think, you know, the big distinction that I've made when thinking and writing about this is litigation firms versus deal-making or transactional firms. So broadly speaking, this is simplifying a bit, but not too much. There's sort of two types of lawyers at large corporate law firms. One is the litigators, and these are the folks who, you know, who appear in court. They deal with kind of adversarial matters. One party, you know, one company threatens to sue another company, or they do sue another company, or the government comes after you, and that could ultimately end up in court. So these are the litigators, the people that you tend to see on TV when you watch a legal drama. Then there are the deal makers, and these are the folks that you hire when you have a big transaction that you want to complete. So you're a company and you're a big tech company and you want to buy a tech startup. Well, you need a transactional lawyer to, you know, to drop all the contracts and to get that deal done. Or if you're a company that's been private and you want to go public and you want to issue shares to the public, same thing. You need to hire transactional lawyers. You need to, you know, they do all this kind of documents that allow you to issue shares. You know, maybe you want to get a big debt offering, you know, same thing. So the litigators and the deal makers, while they, you know, oftentimes work at the same firm, they do very different things, and they have a kind of different sociology and a different worldview. And I would say the litigators, you know, they're not saints by any stretch. You know, they care about profits and they care about the business they bring in. But it is, there is a kind of particular worldview that the litigator has that's sort of baked into their minds from early on. And that is that one thing that they're there to do is to defend clients against government overreach. This often starts, you know, when they're sort of baby lawyers doing pro bono work. You know, at Paul Weiss, for example, a lot of their young lawyers would do work on things like stop and frisk policies in New York City, defending clients. You know, sometimes it's defending homeless clients against landlords, things like that. But they're there to kind of fight, or they're taught that they're there to fight against very powerful forces that may come after your client. And so it's a mindset that says, you know, we have to be very wary of people that, you know, that might use coercive power. And the deal makers are it's a much different mindset. It's, you know, they're not like writing legal briefs. They're not, their noses aren't in case law. They're not showing up in court constantly. They're really just there to get a deal over the finish line. It's a very pragmatic mindset, a very sort of, you know, results-oriented mindset. And so if you think about that in the context of this Trump executive order, you can imagine the litigators saying, you know, we really need to fight this because this threatens everything that we do. What we do, whether we're defending, you know, an indigent client or we're defending a big Wall Street firm, often what we do is we try to keep the government off the back of our client. And the deal makers are thinking about it differently. They're thinking, well, what I do is I try to get a merger over the finish line or an acquisition or an IPO. And in my work, what I need is the approval of government. I'm not fighting government. I'm looking for the blessing of the government. And so these have very different implications for how you might see one of these executive orders. And I think what you find is that the firms that ended up fighting them pretty aggressively, the Jenner and Blocks, the Wilmer Cutlers, the Perkins Coies, a lot more of their business comes from litigation. More of their lawyers are litigators, whereas the Paul Weisses and, you know, other firms that ended up doing deals, Kirkland and Ellis, Skadden Arps, a lot more of their business comes from transactions. And so I think that helps explain why some of these firms fought and the others we're really concerned about making deals.
So let's talk briefly about the downstream effects. Okay, what's happened with respect to these firms who made deals in things in areas like recruiting, in areas like client retention, in areas like partner retention?
Yeah, you know, it's still a little early to say how this is shaking out industry wide, but we've really seen some pretty fascinating data points so far. We've seen a number of partners leave Paul Weiss. Almost all of them have been litigators, you know, the kind of people that we've been talking about who do adversarial work, who often take on the government, not seeking to make a deal with the government. A number of these litigators, including a very prominent partner named Karen Dunn, who was an advisor to Hillary Clinton and Kamala Harris, Karen Dunn and several of her colleagues recently left Paul Weiss to set up their own sort of boutique litigation firm. Now, they say that didn't have to do with the deal that Paul Weiss made, but it's a very interesting data point. You know, the timing is very interesting. It came after the deal, and the people who left were litigators who might have found it difficult to do business, you know, the same way they did before the deal was made. So we've seen some very high-profile partners leave these firms. We've also seen some very high-profile clients replace these firms. I wrote a piece a month and a half ago or so about Microsoft, which replaced a firm that had made a deal with the Trump administration, Simpson Thacher, with another firm that is fighting the Trump administration, Jenner and Block. And this was a pretty high profile case that had gone to court in Delaware related to a big acquisition that Microsoft had made. So we've definitely seen some big clients move. The Wall Street Journal had a big piece about this a couple weeks ago and identified a few other very high profile companies, including Citadel, the big alternative money management firm. They also had been very clear about wanting to replace some firms that had done deals with the Trump administration with firms that were fighting the administration. So there have been some very high profile clients. As I said, it's a little early to say kind of systematically whether we're gonna kind of see it in the sort of bottom lines of these firms and these clients, but we've certainly seen some very high profile data points so far that indicate that this is having an effect on, you know, on everything from where partners wanna be to which firms clients wanna use in different matters.
Now, is the inverse true also? Have new clients and partners come onto the firm?
You know, I think that's interesting. I think for the firms that did deals, their hope was more like, we just don't want to lose our clients. We don't want to lose partners who do transactional work. I think one thing that I may not have made clear, but I think very much looms over this is for the last few decades at least, the transactional work tends to be more lucrative. A lot of it is working with private equity firms when they acquire companies or issue a lot of debt. And these are deals that are often, billions or even tens of billions of dollars. And so when you're doing a multi-$10 billion deal, you're not super sensitive to how much you're paying for the legal work that you have. You know, that tends to be really at the margins. And so it's very profitable for these law firms because they have a lot of pricing power. You know, the client isn't super price sensitive. And so I think a lot of the firms who did deals, I think they were happy to make this, they're not excited that some litigators are leaving, but they're not sad because what they really wanted to do was preserve the deal making lawyers and the big transactional clients. And I think, for the most part, they've done that. So what I think we've seen is, some loss of litigation clients, some loss of litigators, litigation partners, but the firms that did deals have generally hung on to the big transactional clients, the big private equity firms. And that was their hope in doing these deals.
And I suppose it's also too early to tell what's going to happen when the different interpretations of what these deals say mean when the rubber meets the road. Noam Schreiber, thanks thanks for spending time talking with us this morning. Noam, we know you're working on a book, Mutiny, The Rise and Revolt of the College-Educated Class. I hope you'll be willing to come back and chat with us about it when it's published.
Yeah, would love to do that. Really enjoyed talking to you guys.
All right, we'll be right back after this.
Thank you.
It looks like a great way to realize the American dream. You can be your own boss, and with a positive attitude and hard work, you can land in a world of Cadillacs and mansions. At least that's the promise of something being sold by companies engaged in what's called multi-level marketing, an approach that others have labeled as nothing but a pyramid scheme. Author Bridget Reed takes us on a tour of this rather murky world in her new book, Little Bosses Everywhere. We're very lucky to be joined by her this morning. Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money.
Hi, good morning.
So Bridget, what motivated you to write this book and how long did it take you to do the research?
I worked on a short article about multi-level marketing during the pandemic in 2021. We did a whole issue in the magazine I work for on how women were more impacted by pandemic unemployment than men. And I just kind of became obsessed with the industry from there. So it took about 4 years plus to research and write the book.
It's a really fascinating world, and we'll get to the pandemic because I think that is marks one of many chapters where multi-level marketing sort of snaps back into the forefront. But let's start with the origin. You trace it to a company called Nutrilite. Can you share a bit about the men who created Nutrilite and the key characteristics of something that we see repeated in all these businesses, the plan?
Multi-level marketing was invented by two salesmen who kind of came upon another in the 1940s. They met a man called Carl Renborg, who had a homemade vitamin company called Nutrilite. And, you know, I'm not the first person to discover these guys. Much of what we know about Nutrilite comes from Amway, because Amway eventually took over Nutrilite. The two founders of Amway trained in Nutrilite, and eventually Amway bought the company. And then another author named Bob Fitzpatrick, who is a leading expert on MLM, he also talked about these guys in his book, which is called Ponzinomics. It's a great book. Check it out. Anyway, they met in the 40s. The architects of the plan, a Stanford-trained psychologist named William Castleberry and a former funeral plot salesman named Lee Mittinger. They were salesmen who sold door-to-door products, had experience selling door-to-door, which was a sort of crappy industry, you know, low pay, subject to the whims of the market and to the weather. You can think of Fuller Brush or Avon as examples of these sort of older companies, Americana. And they really used the classic wholesale model where distributors bought products at a wholesale rate and sold them for a profit. And there really wasn't much to that. You could kind of move up the ladder, get more salesmen under you, and get a commission based on their sales, but that was really it. And what these guys did is they essentially imported the Ponzi scheme into a direct selling outfit. So instead of salesmen being rewarded on what their recruits were selling, which is very difficult, like I was just saying, you know, selling stuff door to door, even then in the 40s, was hard, right? I mean, you have Death of a Salesman published in 1947. So this is, you know, direct selling had a bad reputation. And these guys said, okay, we're going to do away with that. And instead, people in this system will be rewarded on what they buy and what their salesmen under them in their downline buy. So they got rid of the worst part of direct selling, which was the sales, and instead created this system where people could be rewarded on how many other salesmen they recruited into the scheme. And supposedly it could go on forever, which was another selling point, right? So a salesman could recruit as many people as possible, and if they were really good at recruiting, they could build a whole team under them. And that's the plan as it was born. It was called a profits pyramid before that was a bad word. And that was in 1945. And so they took the product that they used to set up the plan was Nutrilite, using this guy Carl Renborg's vitamins. And that's kind of the quick and dirty origin story.
But before we go on, like, were the vitamins, like, were they selling them? Was it actually an interesting a product that would attract, you know, purchasers?
At the time, the vitamin industry was sort of nascent. The federal government was still catching up to regulating vitamins, so they were able to make kind of wild promises about the vitamins. They had a sales booklet called How to Cheat Death. So that just gives you an idea of the kind of promises they were making about these alfalfa vitamins. But you know, there was also huge competition for these products. Bayer, Merck, you know, big pharmaceutical companies that we know today were already making vitamins that you could buy at the store in the 1940s. So there was, you know, no reason really that a door-to-door selling outfit with salesmen selling vitamins would do better than a regular retail operation. So that's why the business opportunity was such a more enticing marketing plan to sell recruits. They were told they were small businessmen. They owned their own business because they were independent contractors. So they weren't signing up to be, you know, just one sort of employee. They were told they could build these businesses as big as possible. So from the get-go, vitamin sales were really not the innovation of the business. What the innovation was that recruiting.
Gotcha. And we almost have that in inside sales, where you have the salespeople and then the sales manager who gets a cut of all the, you know.
Yeah. And the difference is that those managers are getting a cut based on the actual sales that are documented by the salespeople, right? You know, you have to be making your quota of sales and have real documented customers to be a successful salesman in a traditional model. What these guys did, again, and it's in their own documentation, through, you know, what Amway has put out historically about Nutrilite, but also in subsequent lawsuits. Nutrilite was first sued by the FDA in the 50s. And from those materials, from their actual sales plan, what people were rewarded on in this system was what they called purchase volume. So all that mattered was that they were buying vitamins and the salespeople under them were buying vitamins. And there really aren't rewards in this system based on actual sales to actual customers, which is why in this company and many, many companies that followed using the plan, people end up with tons of product in their basements because no one cares who's selling these products.
Right, right.
So you just mentioned that this thing was marketed as a be your own boss. How did the popular literature about the power of positive thinking align with the marketing of MLM schemes like Nutrilite and later Amway?
Well, two of the men who invented the plan in Nutrilite, Castleberry, the psychologist I described, and Carl Renborg, the vitamin entrepreneur, they met in a Dale Carnegie course. So Dale Carnegie, if you haven't heard of him, you know, is the author of How to Win Friends and Influence People, which was a remarkable self-help tome that was a huge bestseller in the United States, published first in 1936, which tells you that positive thinking, though its origins are even older than that, during the Depression and in the tail end of the Depression, so in the 30s, when the country was still very much recovering from the devastation of the Great Depression, self-help really exploded as a category. Positive thinking, literature of all kinds from that kind of, you know, self-help texts like Dale Carnegie, where it's sort of courses, to a sort of more mystical kind of subset of people who were teaching the principles of manifestation, that if you were unhappy, that you could, through meditation, actually change your physical environment. Another guy in this kind of genre who did very well at the time is Napoleon Hill, who wrote Think and Grow Rich. The men who started MLM, we don't exactly know, but Napoleon Hill actually authored an article about them in the 50s as examples of people who followed his mind matter principles. So again, people who were supposedly manifesting success because they were not, you know, doing anything to change the system, right? But they were just putting out good energy to bring back success. This kind of the positive thinking movement very much channels the idea that you can improve your circumstances yourself alone, you know, individually. It's very much an individualistic doctrine. And you can trace it all the way to Donald Trump, who as a child attended church where the pastor was Norman Vincent Peale, who wrote another positive thinking book, The Power of Positive Thinking, in the 50s. Again, another bestseller. And these books tend to really go viral when the economy is bad and people really are desperate and need something to hold on to. And these books tell you, you don't need the government, you don't need a program, you don't need handouts. You really have everything you need within you, whether you're tapping into just your entrepreneurship or whether you're tapping into like a literal mystical energy money god that's going to give you money.
Good. Hey, so jumping into the book, there's a character, Monique, with Mary Kay Cosmetics. How was she drawn further and further into the world of Mary Kay? And do you think her experience was typical of the Mary Kay world?
Well, the first thing that drew Monique in was her circumstances. She was a veteran. She left the military with retirement benefits. And so she had a sort of stable income, but very low. She was only getting $1,200 a month from the government. And she was living in Florida and didn't really have a kind of safety net that she was kind of let into the world with, in terms of a community, friends, and then prospects for how to make more money. So when she encountered a Mary Kay salesperson who told her, you don't need a fancy education, you don't need a huge amount of startup capital. Again, you can start your own small business and you can be an entrepreneur and make an, not just an income, you can get rich. That's what she was told, you know, at this recruiting event. She was shown, you know, people winning iPads and trips on yachts and buying cars with their, you know, substantial Mary Kay income. So that's how she got in. And then the second thing that happens when you join Mary Kay is you spend money. Very much she was induced to spend because she was told, A, you need to use the products you are selling. B, the compensation plan actually rewards buying more and more at one time. So very quickly, she spent $1,800, which in Mary Kay gets you to a rank that's called Star Consultant. So that's right away before you've even sold a product, you're called Star Consultant, which just gives you an idea of how little product sales actually matter in this system. And it just goes up from there, right? So at the end of a Mary Kay fiscal year, a queen of sales, and I'm using air quotes around sales, might be celebrated for selling $20,000 worth of Mary Kay products. In reality, and I've seen this on their back end system, what's only tracked is the wholesale purchases. So that retail amount, $20,000, it's just a hypothetical. What has actually happened is the salesperson and her team have purchased $10,000 worth of Mary Kay, and they're celebrated for that. So all up the compensation ladder in Mary Kay, consultants are constantly induced to spend. You know, and that's just on top of the fact that to stay active in Mary Kay or in any MLM, you have to be purchasing every month. You have a sort of base amount that you're required to buy. So you could see how rapidly you're spending money. And then if your uplines are constantly telling you, oh, it'll come back one day once you build a team, you'll get all of that investment back. You're really told that it's an investment in a small business. Just like, you know, maybe a startup, a tech guy is going to lose money in his first year of business. They have a lot of different sort of adages that they'll use when you look at your bank account and you see you're in the red to make you not sort of stop and think, why am I spending so much money on something that's supposed to make me money?
One of the things about the book, you know, when I hear about Amway or even Mary Kay, I always sort of wondered, how would people think this was going to work? One of the things you do in the book is you sort of talk about the kinds of recruiting and other kinds of meetings and the psychological pressures that are used to manipulate these people. Can you share a little bit about what a Mary Kay meeting would look like? This really got me as I read the book.
A Mary Kay meeting will be overwhelmingly positive, which honestly is sort of the first thing that gets people in the door. You know, we don't necessarily have, especially post-pandemic, right? A lot of our sort of social fabric, I think, was torn apart. And we don't necessarily have those third spaces or just places where people are meeting and in community. I think women especially are vulnerable to this. If you need to stay home a lot of the day and do childcare, there's a lot of loneliness, you know? And so a Mary Kay meeting is overwhelmingly positive, supportive. And honestly, there's a revival element. You know, Mary Kay is a very explicitly Christian company, and many MLMs take that church revival atmosphere where there's a lot of positivity and a lot of testimony. So that's the other thing is Mary Kay will encourage recruits to really confess their sort of deepest feelings, what's holding them back, their struggles. And so, you know, there's a lot of talk of illness, of debt, of, you know, marital, you know, situations, right? All of these things that might make somebody vulnerable to want to change their circumstances. So that kind of breaks people down, and then you get lifted up right away, right? With all of this talk of making money, changing your life, maybe you're going to get out of debt, maybe you'll send your kids to college, maybe you'll buy a new home, you know, sort of the American dream is dangled in front of you right away. And, you know, again, even the most discerning person at this meeting, I think there's so much positivity, and especially if it's your friends and family, maybe a longtime friend or someone from church who's recruited you, why wouldn't you trust that person? But even if you're discerning enough to then go to, say, the FTC website and Google multi-level marketing, you know, you'll see there that the FTC has very confusing warnings about this industry, right? Well, it's legal, but many MLMs are fraudulent, even non-fraudulent MLMs. you might lose money, you know, so even the most kind of discerning person might not get the red flags right away, especially if they're being bombarded with a lot of love and attention.
And one of the other fascinating parts of the book is when you managed to go to a Mary Kay convention. Rather than get into that, I want to talk a little bit about Amway before we start running out of time. It's probably the best known of the MLM companies. How did Jay Van Andel and Richard DeVos come to found Amway?
So like I referenced earlier, DeVos and Van Andel were early recruits in Neutralite, and they were very good at building a big organization of Neutralite participants in Michigan, where they're from. And, you know, starting a pattern that has repeated itself throughout the 80 years of MLM, they've basically quickly realized that even the best recruits are not doing as well as the MLM company itself, which is selling these products, right? Even the, you know, the most successful downline with thousands of recruits, they still have to buy every month from Neutralite, which was also, you know, Mittinger and Castleberry was the distributor for Neutralite. Anyway, so they started their own company before they even had a product. They took their big downline in Michigan and they said, we're going to do the plan ourselves. And they called it American Way. Quickly, they figured out they were going to sell soap. They had a liquid cleaner that they used, but then they expanded to absolutely everything. You know, now you could buy an Amway air purifier, you could buy Amway makeup, you could buy an energy drink. So they really sell everything. And Amway became the most politically influential and powerful multi-level marketing company because DeVos and Van Andel, starting almost right away in the 1960s, built political alliances predominantly on the right wing, and some of which is being felt today. So they very quickly, you know, became the dominant force in MLM. And finally, in the 70s, when the FTC was trying to regulate MLM, they really had built those alliances in such a way that they were able to get regulatory cover and have this sort of gray area established around MLM in 1979. And that's really the only thing that has ever, you know, the federal government has really, this is its only power to rein in MLM.
Yeah. So backing up a little bit, so we talked about the power of positive thinking helping to push the MLMs. Now, did the selling of motivational tapes and materials become a major source of revenues for MLMs?
Yeah, and this is really well documented among internally in multi-level marketing companies, because not only do former distributors in MLMs like Amway, like Herbalife, they've sued these companies for being pyramid schemes. They also have sued each other over these massive motivational companies that are sort of these cottage industries within MLMs, excuse me, that are called the tools. So Amway actually has had decades of controversy over these tools businesses because the motivation has become in many ways much bigger than the soap selling. Because especially in the 70s, when the economy was so bad, there was this huge market for motivational speaking, tapes, books. One notorious MLM was actually started just on the basis of selling self-help. It was called Dare to Be Great. It was by this guy, Glenn Turner, and it was a sort of national sensation, and it was eventually shut down by the FTC. But yeah, I mean, the Amway downline kind of kingpins is the term that Amway people use. They started their own tools businesses that are in many ways way more successful than the soap selling itself. And, you know, there are internal Amway documents that actually show the kind of head honchos in the corporate company saying, wait, this is worrisome. A, this could be a pyramid scheme. B, you know, we don't have control over these companies because they're selling, you know, other products. This guy, Dexter Yeager, who's sort of been lost a little bit to history, but was a huge Amway salesman, again, using air quotes around salesman, in North Carolina, he's established a sort of huge speaking and motivational business such that he's kind of remembered for that much more than being a salesman.
So we've talked a little bit about the founders of Amway. I think it'd be useful for the audience to get a sense of just how much money the people at the top have been able to take out of a company like Amway.
So, I mean, the Amway founders, both of whom have passed away, when they died, they were billionaires many times over. And Amway remains one of the top 100 private companies in the United States. So, you know, on that list is, you know, maybe like KFC, right? ask yourself why Amway is a top 100 private company in the United States, and you probably can't name something a product, or you've never tried one, right? So that's the dissonance with the amount of money these people are raking in every month, not only from Americans, but from around the world. You know, the majority of MLM participants since the 80s have been around the world. So the global South, China, India, Eastern Europe, places where people are a lot more desperate to like get in on an American style economy even than here. Those are the people powering MLM and powering Amway. So since then, they have become among the top private donors to the Republican Party, you know, every year kind of breaking records, you know, sorry, not every year, but in multiple elections, you know, becoming the single largest donor to the GOP or to a Republican candidate, starting with Ronald Reagan, all the way through Donald Trump, who was not the Amway founder's chosen candidate, but they eventually closed ranks around him, which resulted in Betsy DeVos, Richard DeVos's daughter-in-law, becoming Trump's education secretary. And you can, you know, whether you're talking about political donations or the think tanks that their money has powered. So they have given a huge amount since the 70s to the Heritage Foundation, such that on the other side, Jay Van Andel's daughter, Barb Van Andel Gabby, is now the board chair of Heritage. And they give in huge amounts to the Michigan Republican Party. So they have really remade Michigan politics in terms of, you know, funneling money into right to work legislation, into private education. You know, they want to end public school funding if they can, you know, get rid of the education department. We could go on and on. So they really are dark money funders in the sense that the Mercers, the Kochs, you know, these names that have become synonymous with big GOP donors, the Van Andels and the DeVos's should be up there.
Yeah.
We're getting to the end, but as you looked at this industry, how many of, what do they call it, IBOs, independent business owners, how many of the Amway IBOs or the Mary Kay consultants, how many of them actually make any money?
We really don't know for sure because the, you know, required disclosures in this industry, there's really very, very little, right? The companies get to self-regulate. They actually have a self-regulatory council where they kind of police themselves. But even in those cases where we do have disclosures, in other countries, for example, like in Canada, Mary Kay and Amway have to put out these income disclosures, which show the average, you know, commissions from the company people are making. I mean, even the quote successful distributors, they're making a fraction of an income that would be considered, you know, a successful income, right? So maybe top 10% are making, you know, $110 a month or something. And that's before expenses. Other studies, you know, when the FTC finally did go after Herbalife, they said an overwhelming majority of people lost money in the company. So the statistics are dismal. The statistics of success in these companies look much more like participating in a lottery than they do, you know, trying to do a business opportunity. And in terms of people actually making a real income, we're talking a fraction of a percent, you know, and that's according to the companies themselves.
You know, as I was reading the book, I turned to my computer and put Amway into Google to see if it was still there and saw all these like glowing ads. Why does this keep working?
Sometimes, honestly, because they don't even use the name Amway, right? People I spoke to were recruited into the names of these LLCs, of these downline organizations, which are called things like Dream Builders or Leadership Development. You don't really find out you're joining Amway, or maybe it's even Herbalife, until you're sort of four meetings in and you've made friends with these people and they've showered you with compliments and they've told you you're going to be a huge success and they're doing financial mentorship or they're leveraging e-commerce. Like MLMs have really started using the terminology of the internet, the terminology of digital marketing to kind of camouflage that they're just these like 80-year-old companies that have a sort of trail of devastation behind them. And also just, you know, desperation. We continue to unfortunately have an economy where, you know, inequality is becoming the status quo. And I think in any society where there's such, you know, unequal outcomes, people are going to really be susceptible to a pitch where no matter who you are, you really can change your life. And that's what MLM will never change about its pitch.
And I think we should end the interview much as you end the book, by talking about what happened to Monique in the end.
Oof. Well, in the end, she estimates $75,000, but that's really a low estimate, and that doesn't take into account all of her expenses. You know, in an MLM, because you're an independent contractor, you're shelling out for nearly all of your business expenses too. And she really also lost all of those friends and people she thought of as family, who she came in contact with at Mary Kay over her years of being involved in the company. So it's really almost like the deprogramming that occurs when people leave MLM, because the other people still inside the company are really taught to shun any detractors. She left the company having spent a huge amount of money. She has still a huge amount of debt that she's working toward getting out of. But she was able to stop spending money on products she didn't need, which I think is a huge victory and really is the best outcome for any MLM story.
Did she end up with a storeroom full of unused Mary Kay products?
Oh, absolutely. And unfortunately, many of those expired. So she can't even, sort of sell them on the Mary Kay black market, which is robust with all kinds of consultants trying to sell this stuff that they have bought. But yeah, I mean, much of it is still around and she's trying to get rid of it as we speak.
The book is engrossing and actually rather sad when you read about these people who are taken into this. Little Bosses Everywhere. How the Pyramid Scheme Shaped America. We've been speaking with Bridget Reed. Bridget, thanks for spending so much time with you. And I'm going to apologize for a little scheduling mix-up as we got started. We appreciate your patience and we appreciate your time.
Thanks so much.